welcome to another episode of Free Lunch by The Peak, the podcast where we talk to people way smarter than us about the most important topics in Canadian business, economics, and policy. I'm your co-host, Taylor Scollin.
And I'm Sarah Brightnika.
So Sarah, one of the things that we have been writing about a lot and thinking about a lot reading the news lately is industrial policy, because it really is such a big deal now with, you know, the IRA and the CHIPS Act in the States, and then the massive amounts of subsidies and, well, investment subsidies, call it what you want, that are being spent here on things like battery plants for electric vehicles, this whole clean energy transition. All of these things are getting a lot more attention and funding than they ever have. But at the same time, it's really hard to assess whether they're working or not and what outcomes we're supposed to be getting from them.
Or whether they will work down the line, which is the intended goal. Like, similar to you, the investments that the U.S. announced however long ago now in terms of the green energy economy / transition, just billions and billions of dollars, like, opened the floodgates. And it's not just Canada trying to keep up. It's also now Europe, and like, everyone's involved and, you know, handing over billions and billions of dollars to these EV makers. And like you said, it's not totally clear on what the outcomes are going to be. And for me, having followed business news for quite some time now, it's also the first time that I've read about the government getting involved in such a big way to prop up in industry. It's the first time I've seen it. I don't know if you can think of anything comparable, but that's also interesting to me.
Yeah, well, I think it has been kind of a paradigm shift in how governments and policymakers are thinking about the economy and issues like this. And certainly over the course of our lifetimes, you know, the credo has been sort of let the market decide everything. And yeah, I think that's changed quite a bit. But, you know, it is fairly new that, well, but, you know, we still don't know a lot about how these policies are going to work, how this is going to play out. But we do have some researchers who are doing really excellent, interesting work at the cutting edge of this field. And one of them is joining us today to walk us through her research on industrial policy and what she's found with some, I would say, pretty innovative methods of looking at industrial policies around the world and some of the outcomes associated with them. So Rekha Juhas is an assistant professor of economics at the University of British Columbia and the co-founder of the Industrial Policy Group, which is a research lab that's looking at empirical research around industrial policy. Rekha, thanks so much for joining us on Free Lunch.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
So let's just start with the basics here. Can you explain what industrial policy is and how it's different from economic policy more generally?
Sure. So actually, this is quite a tricky question. And there is, I think, a fair amount of confusion amongst both academics and practitioners to what industrial policy actually is. The definition that I've used in some of my work, and I think it's actually pretty helpful, is not one that is based on kind of the particular policy instrument that is associated with industrial policy, but it's sort of more abstract. So the way that we think about industrial policy is that it is sort of intentional government action that is directed at trying to change the composition of economic activity. That is, it's trying to change sort of the composition of what is produced domestically in the service of some sort of public goal. So historically, that public goal has been fostering industrialization, boosting manufacturing, which is where the name comes from. But of course, that has evolved a lot over time. And so today, I think most people don't associate industrial policy just with efforts to boost specific sectors of manufacturing, but really any government action that is trying to purposefully and intentionally change what is produced domestically.
It's interesting that you leave money out of that definition. And I'm wondering if there are economists that would disagree with you in the sense that it is government putting money towards kind of key industries? And maybe if you could talk about what those specific actions are if they're not money.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think it often is associated with the government putting money towards certain industries. And that is certainly one type of industrial policy. Though I would also say that the government spends money on industries for lots of reasons, not just for industrial policy reasons. But a very good counterexample, and this was really kind of the historically common use of industrial policy, is tariff policy, right? Tariffs are actually something that doesn't cost the government money. It's something that actually raises fiscal revenue. And by putting in place a protective import tariff, for example, you're raising the domestic price of that product. And in that way, you're promoting and you're trying to incentivize the entry of domestic firms by sort of shielding them in this way from foreign competition. So that's sort of a good counterexample of a policy that actually, instead of costing money, raises fiscal revenue, but may serve, in some cases, industrial policy end.
That might be a good place to stay for a second to help tease out this distinction a little bit more. So that's an example of tariffs being used for industrial policy. Are there examples that come to mind of tariffs being that are not being used for industrial policy, just to make that distinction more clear?
Yeah, so this is where things get tricky, and this is why my co-authors and I really try to sort of push back on associating individual instruments with industrial policy, because the correspondence works in neither direction. So tariffs historically have most often, I think, been used to raise fiscal revenue. So historically, in the 19th century, when fiscal capacity was much more limited, the main way for governments to raise revenue was through tariffs. And so that is why when you just look at the tariff schedule of a country, it's particularly in developing countries today, it's not actually obvious that a tariff is used for industrial policy rationales.
Okay. What about a policy like the $10 per day childcare that the federal government here has pursued? You know, they've talked about how the goal is to help get more women into the workforce, things like that. Would that be an industrial policy?
So again, it kind of depends on what the intention of the policy may. The way I understand this policy initiative is exactly as you say. It's more to promote workforce participation without a particular sort of focus. It's not that the government is trying to sort of change the structure of what is produced domestically in a certain way. This is more about trying to get predominantly women, but working parents in general, back into the workforce more quickly. So in that sense, that's sort of a policy that doesn't strike me as having obviously industrial policy intentions. A similar sort of policy that does, I think, have very clear industrial policy intentions would be something like a lot of the workforce training that is tied to the CHIPS and Science Act in America, that is trying to sort of train and equip the workforce with the skills needed to do advanced semiconductor manufacturing. So that is also some sort of workforce policy, but because the intentionality is explicitly tied to semiconductor manufacturing, to changing the composition of economic activity, we would, I think, typically think of that as an industrial policy, whereas the $10 a day childcare or daycare is probably more of a general economic policy and not something that's industrial policy.
Okay, that's a helpful clarification. That makes a lot of sense. When it comes to the reasons that governments provide for industrial policy, I'm curious, what are some of the common rationales and how have they evolved over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So modern economics has sort of a variety of kind of very widely accepted rationales for doing industrial policy. The most common one is the classic sort of market failure. This is just an instance of a case where the market doesn't function well and the market doesn't provide socially desirable outcomes. So a good example to give here is sort of is the climate crisis and carbon emissions, because the firm or the emitter of CO2 emissions doesn't internalize fully the costs of emitting CO2, we end up actually producing without any sort of government intervention, just in a free market system, we end up producing far more CO2 than what is socially desirable, which is where there is then the rationale for government to step in. There are many of these market failures that justify industrial policy intervention, and that is really kind of the classic justification. The second one that we sort of put down in a recent paper is activity-specific public inputs. So these are things that economists, I think, typically think of more as what are known as horizontal policies. So think of something like building a port. People typically think of that as kind of benefiting the economy at large without sort of picking certain winners. But, you know, in practice, when the policymaker is actually sort of choosing, you know, where to put a certain infrastructure like a port, if they sort of explicitly take into consideration, well, there's this industry here that really needs the port, then that is actually going to be industrial policy because they choose sort of where that public input is going that's going to sort of go hand in hand with private production in a way that is kind of designed to favor a particular industry. So that's also, I think, another well-accepted example of a justification for industrial policy.
There's a strong argument against industrial policy, I think, among economists, which is basically that the government is unable, or governments are unable, to kind of pick the right industries to invest in. They don't know what they're doing, and they just end up wasting money and kind of distorting the economy. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the kind of classic pushbacks for why the government shouldn't be in the business of doing industrial policy. So if I need to sort of taking a step back, if I want to kind of think about where I think the disagreement is with economists, you know, people accept that these market failures exist. What you're talking about is the cure going to be worse than the disease? So they're talking about kind of government failure. If government comes in to try to fix this, is government just going to make a bigger mess of things? And I think there are two sort of primary reasons why people believe that government may end up sort of making a really big mess of things. One is political capture. And the second one is the one that you're talking about. The government just doesn't have the type of information that it needs to be able to pick these winners. So political capture, I think, is actually something that is the bigger problem. With information problems, you know, I think that just looking around the world today, you know, if you think about sort of what are the industrial policies that the policymakers are engaging in, they've chosen green industrial policy to confront the climate crisis. I think there's like very little debate amongst reasonable people that is an industry that is subject to market failures for a wide variety of reasons. If we look at the boost, if we look at the push to kind of boost semiconductor capabilities outside of East Asia, there again, I think people can disagree about whether this is going to work or not. But there again, I think there's very little pushback as to whether the government is kind of picking an industry where one could make a reasonable case. So I think actually this challenge of picking winners is less of an issue in practice than people make out.
I'm hoping that we could kind of talk a little bit about the other side of the argument through examples. And so it might be helpful to talk about some successful applications of industrial policy that have kind of led us to this point. So in Canada's history, where have we seen those types of successes?
So that's actually a good question. I think there's some nice work that looks at industrial policy in Canada through the use of tariff policy. I'm blanking on the details a little bit, but my recollection is that they were looking at sort of a period where protective tariffs on manufacturing were raised in the late 19th, early 20th century. And they tend to find that the industries that received higher tariff protection, these manufacturing industries witnessed faster growth of the sector. Beyond that, I think the best evidence we have comes actually from outside of Canada. So one sort of canonical example of industrial policy that has received kind of a lot of academic attention and where there's been sort of, I think, a lot of high quality work is South Korea's heavy chemicals and industrial drive in the 1970s. So my co-author, Nathan Lane at Oxford, has done some really nice work that shows that those industries in South Korea, which received this really big industrial policy push, partly through credit lending, partly through a reduction in the input tariffs that they needed, so the inputs that they needed to get the manufacturing off the ground, that those seem to have sort of shifted the comparative advantage. They seem to have shifted sort of what industries Korea was kind of dominant in export markets. And I just want to sort of take a step back from kind of the wonkish details and kind of give you the context for Korea, because I think this is kind of a really nice sort of teaching example in the sense that the Koreans were trying to do this heavy chemical and industrial drive for a long time. And no one believed that, like, a small, poor country that was really doing light manufacturing, that had a very small internal market, that they could get into this, like, very scale-intensive industries like steel. This was so much the case that, like, the World Bank refused to give loans for, like, the initial steel plants that they wanted to establish. The reason this is nice is that it's kind of hard to make the case that without the intervention, Korea was kind of on the cusp of these industries taking off. They eventually ended up using some Japanese reparations to fund the initial push, and you really see this kind of striking change in what Korea started to produce. And you know, many people know about the East Asia miracle, but it's kind of easy to miss that at the end of the Second World War, a lot of these East Asian countries, you know, South Korea in particular, was as poor as African countries. And so this kind of astonishing transformation, structural transformation, industrialization that they went through is really unprecedented at the time. You know, only Japan up to that point had been producing growth rates and progress in manufacturing that was similar. And what we're getting out of this new work, Nathan Lane is sort of the first paper, but now there's sort of multiple papers that are analyzing this episode, is really that the government seems to have played a crucial role in partnering with the market to sort of facilitate this transformation.
Right. And it's interesting that you mentioned Asia as well, because I guess if we're looking at examples where government intervention has been helpful, I mean, like, looking at China, you see enormous success in terms of economic growth and innovation. And that's a country where their government has their hands in every aspect of the economy. So is that, obviously that's not a model that anyone can follow, but what do you make of, I guess, the success in China? And is there anything, I guess, that's interesting about that arrangement to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there as well, like you say, the in some ways it translates not completely to the Western context, just because the state is just sort of much more dominant. But I do think that there as well, we have some nice work from Ernest Liu at Princeton, who has shown that at kind of early stages of China's kind of economic miracle, the state also played a crucial role in targeting certain industries. And I think my sort of read, I'm not a China expert, but my sort of read of what the Chinese have done is that in many, many cases where you see their manufacturing prowess, you know, electric vehicles is just the latest example, there has been a plethora of government intervention. It's hard for me to look at China and not think that industrial policy of this very kind of distinctive flavor with a lot of kind of much more dominant state intervention, that this industrial policy has had likely an important role to play.
Are there any common traits that we can learn from successful examples of industrial policy or from failed industrial policies? Anything that is a common thread between those that we could apply?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the thing that keeps me up at night. This is where I think particularly research in economics has been lagging, and where we desperately need more research. But I think there are a couple of themes that emerge. I mean, one thing I would say, just linking back to the Korean HCI example, is that what the Koreans pulled off is likely not particularly representative, in the sense that there's this nice paper by Bruce Blenningen in the Economic Journal, which finds that these similar type of steel industrial policies in poor countries typically tend to hurt sort of downstream producers' export performance, which is like a pretty strong signal that the industrial policy is not producing kind of positive spillovers to the rest of the economy. So what, you know, it's an interesting question why the Koreans were able to do what most developing countries were not able to do. I think there are sort of a couple of, clues as to what seems to be an important ingredient to successful industrial policy. One thing that I think many observers point to is a requirement in the medium run that firms and sectors that are receiving this type of support compete on international markets. Because I think the going back to sort of what the threats and what the pushback against industrial policy is, the push is that you're creating sort of a protected, cushy environment for your firms, that it's really corporate welfare that is kind of wasting a lot of taxpayer money. And so one important thing seems to be that the policymaker needs to be able to put in place a lot of kind of mechanisms via which you're really kind of trying to get these firms to do what you want them to do. So one sort of obvious way to try and do that is to make sure that they're competing on international markets where they have to be producing products. They have to be producing products that consumers want to buy. You know, if you have like a super high tariff wall, your consumers might need to use the very low quality steel that you're producing. But you know, no one in a world market where you compete with other producers is going to buy that stuff. So export discipline seems to be sort of one important way in which you can get firms to sort of use the resources wisely and to really sort of try to produce products that have a market. The other thing I think that is important is that, you know, while I don't worry too much about the information problems, industrial policy should inherently be kind of a risky business, and the government much like sort of a venture capitalist, is going to make some bad bets. And more so than sort of trying to prevent the government from making bad bets, what we should focus on is having mechanisms in place that make sure that the government is going to cut their losses. So, you know, take the example that Canada is now sort of putting a lot of subsidies into getting battery manufacturing off the ground for electric vehicles. If that looks like it's not working in 5 to 10 years, there's going to be a lot of political pressure on policymakers to keep the money flowing, because you've created a lot of jobs, you've created a lot of firms that are dependent on these subsidies, particularly if they're not working. But if they look like they're not working, the right thing to do is to sort of cut your losses and get out of there. And that's where sort of the political calculus becomes really tricky, because the policymaker is not going to want to do this. And so, you know, there are mechanisms that you can design to make sure that the policymaker does sort of let the industries go that are not thriving. But that is, I think, that is really where a lot of the tricky political problems come up.
I have kind of a convoluted question, and I apologize in advance for that. But one of the things that stuck out to me reading one of your papers was this example of the metal shipbuilding industry in the United States.
Yeah.
And how that was developed, you know, for reasons that, and for reasons that could not have been predicted at the time, ended up being a very useful thing to have when the Second World War rolled around. And it sort of occurred to me as I was reading that, you know, there could be a lot of examples that are similar to this, where you're developing an industry that is going to have significant benefits down the road, but it's kind of hard to tell in the short term what those benefits are necessarily going to be. So is there a challenge when it comes to even defining success in industrial policies? Or, you know, how do you do that in such a way that, you know, maybe you can account for some of these potential longer term benefits without chasing bad bets, as you say?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And it kind of comes back to why I think the definition of industrial policy that we use in our work is actually helpful. So when you think about how we define industrial policy, it's kind of intentional government action made to or intended to shape what is produced domestically in the service of some goal. And what that goal is, I think, is really important when we think about how we define the success of industrial policy. So if you take sort of the example of the US transition from wood to metal shipbuilding, which is a nice paper by Walker Hanlon. You know, there I think that was not intentional industrial policy, but of course we know that shipbuilding is an industry that has kind of national security benefits, that has military advantages, which is why a lot of countries prize having kind of domestic shipbuilding capabilities. And so when we think about sort of what is the goal of this policy, is the goal of this policy that we want to have metal shipbuilding in the country, or that we want to have the capability to build sort of frontier ships, is the rationale that we think that, take the example of Canada, we think that Canada is particularly well suited to building ships, so this is something that we should be doing, or we think, you know, it's in our national security interest to do so. So even if Canadian shipbuilding doesn't end up being super successful on international markets, we're still going to pour money into this because it's important that Canada has these capabilities. Those are two very different yardsticks, right? Mm. And I think that translates well to sort of something that is very relevant when we think about kind of the West's efforts in acquiring advanced semiconductor capabilities. A lot of that has to do with the national security threat that countries perceive from China. And so there as well, you know, it may be the case that 10 to 15 years down the line, we see countries like the US and European develop some manufacturing capabilities in advanced semiconductors, but they may not be completely competitive on international markets. And that's where I think there's going to be a potentially really difficult conversation about whether it makes sense to kind of keep these industries alive kind of indefinitely if they need subsidies, because the national security benefits are so big. So this is where I think what the goal of the policy is actually becomes extremely relevant. You know, is it that Canada wants to build up EV capabilities because they because we think Canada has some sort of advantage in battery production? And or is it because this is a way that Canada is trying to sort of speed up the green energy transition? Again, those are two sort of different goals. They're not incompatible, but how we measure success, I think, depends on what the goal of the policymaker is.
Those are really interesting questions. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the situation that Canada kind of finds itself in, specifically within the context of industrial policy around EVs, whereas that a lot of these subsidies are exclusively also flowing into companies that are not based in Canada. So could we weigh maybe some of the maybe advantages or disadvantages of that, you know, that value proposition of funding an international company on Canadian soil?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think the trade-off, I'm not an expert on EVs. The way I understand this trade-off is that multinationals have some expertise in EV and battery production. And so at this point in the game, if sort of Canada wants to get a foothold in this industry, it seems much more realistic to use sort of the capabilities that multinationals already have and try to harness some of the spillovers that might accrue from the capabilities that multinationals bring. Of course, the multinationals are also bringing they're bringing jobs and they're bringing sort of their expertise. So I think while kind of this is kind of a legitimate concern to have, I don't think that it's realistic to think about alternative domestic solutions, given sort of where the industry is at.
Right.
I want to ask you about your research specifically using large language models, because I thought that was really interesting, and how you use that technology to analyze what countries, what industrial policies countries were adopting in sort of a new way. Can you describe how you did that and what you found?
Yes, certainly. So basically, the idea for this project came out of where we started this conversation, which is this difficulty of defining industrial policy. That becomes kind of a very practical problem when you try to evaluate industrial policy, because the problems surrounding kind of defining industrial policy then also translate into how you measure industrial policy. So typically, people have measured industrial policy using tariffs, and as we've discussed, tariffs have many tariffs are deployed for a variety of reasons, only one of which is industrial policy. And in the current day and age, tariffs are likely not the most, they're likely not the where we should be looking for industrial policy. Other instruments are more usually used. So what we sort of, what the idea for this project was precisely that based on our definition, which has to do with kind of what the intent of the policymaker is, that industrial policy is very much kind of intentional state action that's trying to change the composition of economic activity, that very sort of naturally led itself to taking a text analysis approach, because this kind of intent of the policymaker, you can't really get out of looking at different policy instruments. You know, you can look at subsidies, you can look at tax policy, you can look at tariff policy. They're not really going to tell you anything about the intent of the policymaker. Our idea was that by looking at the descriptions of the policy, so what policymakers say when they actually implement a policy, we're going to learn a lot more about this intentionality, which we think kind of gets to the heart of what industrial policy is. And so in this project, we use an off-the-shelf mass database of commercial policies. And the nice thing about that is that we have these short descriptions of the policies. And so we're able to use a supervised machine learning model to try to classify at scale whether the intention of the policymaker for a particular policy accords with our definition or not. And so the way we actually do this is we train some graduate students to hand classify a subset of the data. This is why it's supervised machine learning, because we give the model a training data set. And based on this training data set, what the large language model is going to do is it's going to be able to learn sort of what our definition of industrial policy is and then apply it to kind of unseen data. And we see the large language model performing actually really well. And we're able to sort of, for the first time, get some stylized facts about what industrial policy around the world looks like in the past decade or so.
And one of the things that I saw in the paper was sort of a sharp uptick in the number of industrial policies, I suppose, being adopted around the world around, and correct me if I'm wrong here, 2018, I believe, was the year. What accounts for that, do you think?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think the way I would characterize the trend in the data is that from about 2010, which is really when our data starts, we see sort of industrial policy around the world kind of creeping up slowly. There's one acceleration seen. We're not entirely sure at this point, I think, what causes that. And then there's like a much more striking acceleration in 2020. But I think this trend that we're in the world have been saying for years, which is that, you know, even prior to the US's kind of very striking turn to industrial policy with the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, industrial policy has been on the rise globally, at least since the financial crisis. And I think there's a variety of reasons for that. I think the biggest reason, to my mind, is that after sort of decades of belief in what the free market can deliver, I think the last few years, starting with the financial crisis and then kind of shock after shock after shock, we're seeing that the market in and of itself doesn't always deliver desirable outcomes. Some people have been formulating this very nicely as, you know, not all types of growth are equal. This belief that sort of growth is going to trickle down and benefit everyone, that really hasn't played out. You know, we see these striking increases in inequality in many, many countries. We see the hollowing out of middle class jobs, and then of course sort of the elephant in the room has been kind of the rising geopolitical tensions with China, and I would put sort of on par with that just like a pretty sort of stark realization amongst sort of policymakers around the world that the climate crisis is something that is also not going to be fixed easily without government interventions. The market is not going to provide sort of a smooth transition to green energy. And so I think that's where we've seen first sort of this trickle and then really this kind of outright cascade of industrial policy with you know, the US now leading the way in this kind of capital I, capital P industrial policy.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Rekha, thank you so much for joining us. This was a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, Sarah, that was, I found that to be a fascinating conversation and really learned a lot about how different industrial policies have unfolded. Learned a lot about South Korean industrial policy, which was, I want to do some more reading about that because that sounds super interesting. But what were your, what are your thoughts?
Why don't you go and see how it's rolled out and see how it's developed.
See firsthand.
Right, exactly. Well, interestingly, like we keep seeing these like big numbers with billions attached to it. And so I really appreciate how we could kind of unpack that. Well, industrial policy doesn't actually always cost money. There's different ways for the government to get involved. There's different levers that they can pull. But what was interesting to me was what Rekha said was that this is really a moment where industrial policy is taking a bigger role, and kind of because of this, I guess, realization that some governments and industries are having that, I guess the market doesn't always deliver the best outcomes, which is something I kind of need to sit with because it challenges the way that the economy has worked for a very, very long time. And it, I guess, explains why governments are pushing so aggressively into, you know, the green economy where, you know, they're basically building an economy supported by manufacturing, supported by billions of dollars in investments that doesn't effectively exist yet. We're not clear on the demand quite yet. It's probably going to be forced by, you know, through various kind of policy interventions or laws and emissions goals and things like that too. But it's so interesting because it's, we haven't seen this before, and it kind of challenges that thinking that, well, the market always has the answer. The market always works efficiently. If there is an industry that needs to exist, the market will make it so. And that's kind of the points that I'm kind of thinking over right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly, it seems like we forgot how to do industrial policy for a very long time. I mean, at one point in time, I think we did have, you know, tariffs to protect certain sectors and things like that. But that took a backseat for a long time as well. And now we're rediscovering maybe the importance of some of these things in different forms and for different reasons, but nevertheless, directing the economy in ways that, you know, we expect will benefit more people than it would just on its own.
Well, it reminds me of our conversation with Benjamin Bergen, right? Because he's a guy that's really focused on semiconductors and kind of getting Canada in on the supply chain there. And he kind of, you know, unpacked what, you know, kind of, I guess, policy interventions could look like there in the form of like investment. And I think that's an area that is equally of, I guess, concern slash focus around the world that we haven't heard a lot about in Canada. And he was talking with us on like how, you know, how investments in that sector have yet to kind of be realized, if I'm remembering it correctly. But it does take me back to that conversation and how, you know, it just seems like we're kind of all in on EVs right now, but there do need to be maybe other policies to, you know, to support different types of kind of innovations that we've been kind of that as a country, we've been kind of lagging behind relative to the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out for sure. You know, I was struck by sort of what Rekha said about how we don't know a lot about what are the things that make an industrial policy successful, what are the things that make it a failure. You know, she mentioned a couple of the factors that seem to be in play, but it certainly seems like an area that could use more study. So we'll have to keep an eye on that and come back to it sometime in the future.
Definitely.
Okay, well, should we leave it there for now?
I think so.
This has been another episode of Free Lunch by The Peak. If you like this episode, you can find all of our past episodes by searching Free Lunch by The Peak wherever you get your podcasts. And please do go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts to leave us a positive review. It really helps us grow the show. We will see you next week.